Iran summons Slovenia's ambassador to protest the presence of the country's prime minister in a gathering of the MKO terrorist group. Hamas calls for more protests against Israel's land grab policy a day after Israeli forces injured dozens of anti-settlement ralliers in the occupied West Bank. China says it will take necessary measures to safeguard its legitimate rights and interests after the U.S. added 23 Chinese entities to an economic blacklist. It's good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Iran has summoned a Slovenian ambassador in Tehran to strongly protest the participation of the country's premier in a virtual meeting of the MKO terrorist organization. Iranian Foreign Ministry condemned Prime Minister Janez Janzeh's anti-Iran remarks during the meeting as false, unacceptable, and undiplomatic. The minister says supporting a terrorist grouping violates the UN Charter and international norms. The ministry had earlier called the meeting a circus. Tehran says the presence of figures like Janzeh and former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo there was a shameful hypocrisy by the West. The three-day meeting began in Paris on Saturday. The MKO has killed thousands of Iranians in its assassination and bombing campaigns since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Now, let's get some insight and from our guests. I'll be joined by a couple of guests. We'll have Mustafa Khoshchesh, journalist and political commentator in Tehran, and also Masoud Chajer, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joining us from London. Good to have you on the show, gentlemen. Beginning with Tehran first, Mr. Khoshchesh, how do you square this up? I mean, they are claiming human rights, freedom of expression, whatever. They launched a so-called war on terror. They invaded countries. And now they have the most notorious terrorist group, and openly in broad daylight they are supporting in every possible way you can imagine.
Hi, and thanks for having me. Well, you know, the West, the US-led West, is notorious for making an instrumental use of human rights for its hegemonic rule over this region specifically. But the MKO is very much notorious for even the Western audience. They know pretty well about the history and the record, the black record of MKO, MK, Mujahideen Khalo Organization, PMOI, or NCRI, the National Council of Resistance of Iran. They have been assassinating people. They've been killing even Americans before the revolution, after the revolution. They've been killing, over 17,000 Iranian citizens and officials, a president, a prime minister, a judiciary chief, tens of parliament members. And I was a kid in the early years after the revolution. I remember pretty well their armed marches in western streets, in the streets of western Tehran, in Narmak. I remember quite well what they did to us, to the Iranian people. And all Iranians remember pretty well the day when they declared, a collective or a massacre of the Iranians at 2 o'clock p.m. They took out to the streets and they started shooting at anyone that looked like a state person, clerk, employee, staff. And Iranians know the group pretty well, and people in the West, in the East, everyone knows this group. Since they've not been just killing Iranians, they've also been killing many others from, different nationalities. The disavowed members, they've been tortured by the group, and they have killed even Iraqi Kurds and Shiites as foot soldiers of Saddam Hussein. At the end of the war, they helped Saddam Hussein and invaded their motherland, their homeland, Iran, and they killed people in the streets in western Iran. So the group is notorious. It was in the terrorist list of even the United States and the European Union. They were taken off the list back in 2012 when Hillary Clinton was the state secretary for a reason. The reason is the same, that Jake Sullivan, who's now the national security advisor of President Biden, back in 2011, he told her boss, Clinton, that al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda offshoot in Syria, is on our side, the United States side, for the same reason that U.S. allies in this region, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar, were helping ISIS, Daesh, in this region. It's the same reason that Michael Flynn acknowledged to Al Jazeera America that they knew ISIS was about to establish a caliphate in eastern Syria, western Iraq, and they never took action when Obama was in office. Right. The reason is that they make use of these terrorist groups in order to pressure the target countries. In this case, of course, Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, Mr. Shajira, you remember a couple of years ago we had Mr. Pompeo, National Security Advisor, former one, also there in the Paris meeting, I suppose. He was hoping that they would celebrate the victory of what I call the opposition led by the MKO in Tehran, and that was a pipe dream, actually. And they've been doing this for more than four decades. They've been funding the group and the groups like that, and they have gained nothing except notoriety. So how much longer should they continue with this? Isn't it high time for them to change their mind?
Well, I think the history has shown that this sort of terrorists have always been part of the tools that the United States has used, be it in South America or Middle East or elsewhere, to implement their policy. And, you know, really unashamedly, they've been doing that. There was only a very short period after 9/11 where, you know, there was pressure to sort of define who are terrorists and put all of them under the list. Mm-hmm. And indeed, MKO, under all these other names, was put on the list. The fact that MKO is a terrorist organization, and even further, it's a cult, which is abusing its own people. And there was a report by Human Rights Watch, which sort of exposed that precisely and systematically. The reality is that, the Ashraf base, this group was supposed to be standing for democracy and freedom of speech. At the time of Saddam, had the Ashraf base, and they were sort of marching with tanks and so forth, supporting Saddam Hussein. You know, where is the human right? Where is the sort of freedom of speech? You know, one of the greatest tyrants. And they killed, for Saddam, they killed the Kurds, as my colleague said, and they killed people in the south. They have done the bidding of their master, and they've been killing people right the way through their whole existence. Mm-hmm. All that has changed is that they have become the tool of United States, West, and Israel in attacking Iran. And this is really the only reason that they were taken off the list. And, they were taken from the Ashraf base, which was under the hospice of Saddam Hussein, and they moved them all now to Albania. And they still got this similar camp there. There is a secrecy around it. People are being arrested, people are being silent, people are being abused, and they're still continuing killing. You know, the assassinations in Iran would not have been done without the support of this particular group. And they make no, they don't hide the fact. The reality is that they are a tool, and because they're a tool of United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, finance, and so forth, so no one puts the label of terrorism on them. And indeed, they're given protection now in Albania and previously under Saddam. And this is outrageous. It's outrageous that a group like this, a group of people who have done nothing to support or indeed done nothing good in their whole existence, would be allowed to be protected and to be unleashed against innocent people in Iran. And the fact of the matter is that something needs to be done. The fact that West is using tools like this, it actually shows that they have got no regards for values of ordinary human beings in Iran and elsewhere. And the reality, the other reality is that anyone from the Iranian side or indeed international observers know that the most unpopular group in Iran are MKO, because people in Iran have seen exactly what they do. They have seen the damage they've done in mass assassination. They've seen what they've done under sort of supporting Saddam Hussein in the imposed war. They have seen that every single time when it comes to them, they have taken action and position which is against the interests of Iranian. So you know, to actually turn around and say that this is an opposition, this is a created opposition. It's got no support whatsoever in Iran, and all observers have actually unanimously have said this.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Mustafa Vushesh, journalist and political commentator, joining me in Tehran, and Masoud Hajar, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London, with their contribution. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the Palestinians to keep protesting Israel's racist plans, including the land grab policy. Hamas says that the resistance and protests would help foil Israel's expansionist plots. Now, that after Israeli forces attacked Palestinians protesting an Israeli settlement outpost near the occupied West Bank town of Beita. The Palestinian Red Crescent said that the scores of protesters were injured. The settlement has become a focal point of clashes between settlers backed by regime forces and the Palestinians. Several Palestinians have been killed and dozens more wounded over the past weeks. The Israeli authorities have decided to turn the settlement into a military base. Residents want the settlement to be removed. Beijing lashing out at Washington for blacklisting several more Chinese entities over alleged human rights abuses. The Chinese Minister of Commerce says Washington's addition of 23 Chinese entities to an economic blacklist amounts to serious breach of international economic and trade rules. The ministry said that a U.S. move is, quote, an unreasonable suppression of Chinese companies. It underlined that Beijing will take necessary measures to safeguard its legitimate rights and interests. Now, this comes amid an ongoing trade war between the two countries, which have been at loggerheads over several issues, including tariffs on imports. I talked to political commentator Andrew Leung, and he believes that Washington's anti-China policies indicate it's trying to turn itself into a global hegemonic.
There is a great power, a rivalry, not only in trade, but in technology, on the ideology, on the military in the South China Sea, and on human rights, including Taiwan, Xinjiang, Hong Kong, and on values, democracy against so-called authoritarianism. So it's a great power rivalry across the board, 360 degrees. Now, this latest episode reflects in the eyes of Beijing and continuing inability for the United States to think outside the box in the sense that somehow the United States still clings to its perception of world hegemony as if it can call the shots on all matters and over all countries. But this the times have changed in the sense that the American hegemony in decline, not that American power is in decline or its economy is in decline, but its hegemony is in decline in the sense that it can no longer call the shots on everything. And it has got to share power with a rising China. Sooner rather than later, the Chinese economy is going to exceed the United States as the largest economy in the world.
The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on India as the number of infections keeps rising in the world's second most populous nation. It reported well over 42,000 new cases on Sunday, pushing the caseload to 31 million. There were also some 900 new deaths, and that pushed the fatalities to 409,000. India has the world's second highest number of cases and the third largest number of deaths. Experts blame the growing number of infections on the Delta variant. That's a more dangerous and contagious breed of the virus. They say restrictions should be put in place to stem the rise in the number of deaths and infections. Now, Bulgarians go to the polls in the second parliamentary vote in just 3 months after an April election resulted in a fragmented parliament. The vote pits the Conservative Party, a long-serving premier, Boko Borisov, against the anti-establishment party of TV host Slavi Trifonov. They tied at around 20% in the last poll. Both would need support of other traditional parliamentary parties to form a government if they win. Bulgaria is run by an interim government, and that after the April vote failed to produce a government, the former government of Borisov lost public appeal last year amid mass rallies against what demonstrators called entrenched corruption in the establishment. In Moldova, people are also voting in a snap parliamentary election after President Maia Sandu dissolved parliament in April. 101 parliamentary seats are up for grabs in the vote. Early results are expected hours after the polls close at 1800 GMT. Sandu's pro-Western allies hope to take over the chamber after they secure the presidency in 2020. They face a coalition of supporters of former President Igor Dodon, which held a majority of 54 seats in parliament before its dissolution in April. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16, 2021. Some advice to those responsible for conducting the elections. Making the necessary preparations to ensure the voters' health. I have almost finished talking about the elections. I just want to give some advice to those responsible for conducting the elections. May God give them strength that they must make the necessary preparations and predictions to ensure people's health when they go to the ballot boxes because people want to participate in the elections. This participation and going to the ballot boxes must not bring any harm to the health of the society, and this requires certain preparations. Of course, the authorities have announced that they are working on this. I also emphasize that they must definitely work on this. Secondly, they have reported to me that one of the problems we have, which we have faced repeatedly in elections and about which there have always been complaints, is that sometimes in an election center, they say there are no ballot papers left. Or suppose the election started 7 or 8, there are no ballot papers in some centers yet for the people to vote. They must solve this problem. They should ensure that there are no centers without ballot papers. The ballot papers are made available without delay, and that there is no shortage of ballot papers. This was the second point for which the necessary preparations needed to be made. Thirdly, in reports from abroad, they have reported to me that in some of these countries, perhaps in a large number of countries, not all necessary preparations have been made in foreign countries. I asked the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Interior Affairs to make serious efforts to correct this matter, and since there is not much time left to help the Iranians who wish to participate in the elections in foreign countries, to be able to do so. This was the next point. Fourthly, they must deal with any violations. This is what I wanted to say. I ask God the Almighty to guide our hearts. O God, the hearts belong to you and are under your control. Guide all the hearts toward what is good for this country and this nation. May God's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Communique. Benjamin Netanyahu, the man at the head of the Israeli occupation for 12 years, has finally been outplayed. His numerous attempts to stay in power, outmaneuver his opponents, and keep his political rivals at bay granted him a reign lasting from 2009 until 2021, but that has come to a swift end. He's been replaced by Naftali Bennett, a man who proudly claims to be even more right-wing than his predecessor, and has openly bragged about killing Arabs. So the question now is, what difference does this make for Palestinians? What difference does it make for the region, and for those living under Israeli occupation for the better part of almost 80 years? What of their fate?
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Now, before proceeding with the program, it's important to note that Israel is not a legitimate state. It is a racist entity that has been illegally occupying Palestine since 1948, and Syria's Golan Heights since 1967. So when we speak of a so-called Israeli government, we are talking about the administration or the regime that is running the occupation and nothing more. Israel is not recognized as a country by a majority of Arab and Muslim countries and is no more a country than the British occupation in India or the German occupation of Poland or France. Their so-called elections, ministers, and officials have no legitimacy and will only be referred to as such in the program for the sake of simplicity and brevity, nothing more. Now, on June 13, 2021, Benjamin Netanyahu lost his title as the Prime Minister of Israel. In the timeline of events preceding his downfall, many things occurred that led to his ouster. During the last 2 years, from 2019 to 2021, the Israelis had held four elections, all of them inconclusive, as no party was actually able to win a majority out of 120 seats. On April 6, 2021, Netanyahu was given 28 days to form a coalition government, but was unable to do so. And consequently, a few weeks after, on May 5th, the president of the Israeli occupation, Rivlin, turned to another Israeli politician named Yair Lapid, who heads the centrist party Yesh Atid. Just a few days after being given this task, Israel launched a new assault on Gaza on May 10th, with massive bombings of public and health infrastructure, slaughtering hundreds of Palestinians and leaving thousands more wounded. Keep in mind that Netanyahu has been troubled by a massive corruption scandal during the last years, a case that remains open and still not reached a conclusion. And it's widely speculated, and perhaps not unreasonably so, that throughout his tenure, Netanyahu has resorted to many tactics exploiting various crises, such as attacking Gaza, in order to distract from his internal problems and rivalries. Now, his political rivals stopped just short of publicly accusing him of attacking Gaza in May as a ruse to distract from his corruption scandal and troubles of forming a coalition government. And indeed, for a moment, this proved to be fruitful, with multiple outlets reporting that any hopes of a coalition government had been eviscerated. After all, nothing unites Zionists more than the oppression and occupation of Palestinians. But nevertheless, despite his attempts to crush the hopes of his rivals in wrestling the premiership from him, after the ceasefire between Hamas and the Israelis, brokered by Egypt on May 21st, talks between Netanyahu's rivals of forming a coalition government to get rid of him resumed in the wake of the bloodbath that had left so many killed and injured in Palestine. On May 30th, 2021, Naftali Bennett announced that he would be joining with Yair Lapid in the aim of forming a so-called unity government. This would include a coalition of eight different parties from all across the political spectrum. On June 2nd, minutes before the deadline, a coalition government was forged, which would see the role of Prime Minister shared, with Bennett taking the reins for 2 years, and then Lapid. On June 13th, 2021, Naftali Bennett was sworn in as Prime Minister, and during his speech in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, several Netanyahu loyalists attempted to interrupt him, accusing him of treachery as they were being removed from the chamber. Netanyahu himself gave a fiery speech accusing his rivals of election fraud, and much like former US President Trump, refused to accept the results, calling it the greatest election fraud in history, perhaps even in the history of democracy. When entering the Knesset, he sat in the Prime Minister's chair before being told to relocate to a different seat. And in the final moments of his ouster, Netanyahu implied that the new government was doing the bidding of Tehran, of Hamas and Hezbollah, by gifting them with his removal from power. And then he gave a final warning just before he left, saying, quote, "We'll be back." Indeed, he intends to remain the leader of his Likud party and to lead the opposition, with many speculating that Netanyahu will be back and that he'll try to run again and wrestle control of the premiership back into his grasp. Now, what makes the coalition put together interesting is not just the fact that it's comprised of eight parties on seemingly opposing ends of the political spectrum, but also includes for the first time some Israeli Arab politicians as part of the United Arab List. Now, eight parties, all united by their common hatred for Netanyahu, managed to get rid of him. But what of his replacement? What of Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli Prime Minister, and the head of the far-right party, New Right, which is also under the umbrella of the Amina movement, an ultra-nationalist movement? Naftali Bennett originally started outside of politics. He made his fortunes as a tech millionaire, having lived for a while in the United States. His parents are originally American Jews who moved from the United States to occupied Palestine. Like most Israeli settlers, either they themselves, their parents, or their grandparents all come from outside of Palestine. They are not indigenous to Palestine. Just ask any Palestinian where their grandparents were born, and I can assure you, most of them will not tell you the USA or Germany or Ukraine or wherever else. Now, before politics, Bennett was also part of the Israeli occupation forces and took part in numerous attacks on Lebanon, including the Qana massacre in 1996 when the Israelis shelled a United Nations compound, killing 106 Lebanese civilians. Originally, Bennett entered politics under a right-wing party and then went on to join Yamina, which identifies as ultra-nationalist. Once again, it's a bit difficult to understand what they mean here, since every political party there by default validates the Israeli occupation and upholds its existence, which by its very nature oppresses Palestinians in favor of a Jewish nation state. Now, Bennett has always publicly opposed a Palestinian state and always supported the expansion of illegal settlements. At one point, he was the head of the Yesa Council, a large settler organization. Needless to say, these settlers live in Palestine illegally. There are multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions stating very clearly that these settlements are unlawful and stand in violation of international law. When it comes to his animosity and hatred towards Palestinians, there's no shortage of comments there. Perhaps to further illustrate how much of a wonderful person Bennett is, let's look at a few of his quotes, shall we? Bennett once said in 2018 that he would, quote, not give another centimeter to the Arabs. In 2013, during an interview with The Guardian, he said, there is not going to be a Palestinian state within the tiny land of Israel. He previously also expressed his disdain for international law, claiming somehow that Israel's numerous illegal annexations, declared null and void by the United Nations, are not illegal, according to him. In 2012, he was quoted in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz as saying, quote, I will do everything in my power forever to fight against a Palestinian state. He's also called Palestinian children terrorists and said, quote, I've killed lots of Arabs in my life, and there's no problem with that. And of course, this is the man that Western leaders like U.S. President Joe Biden and others immediately call and congratulate and grovel to. You see, racism and terrorism are fine with them as long as it's happening to Arabs and Muslims. Equally, Bennett's cabinet members have no shortage of colorful comments either. Yair Lapid, who will take over after 2 years as the alternate prime minister, said that he is, quote, enthusiastically in favor of annexing the Syrian Golan Heights. My principle says maximum Jews on maximum land with maximum security with minimum Palestinians. The new finance minister, Lieberman, said once in 2006 that, quote, any Arab members of the Knesset who meet with representatives of the PA's Hamas-led government should be executed. And previously, when he was transport minister, on Palestinian prisoners, he said that, quote, it would be better to drown these prisoners in the Dead Sea if possible, since that's the lowest point in the world. Benny Gantz, who was supposed to share the premiership with Netanyahu under a coalition agreement, has now been reappointed defense minister and new deputy prime minister. Just one day after assuming the role of prime minister, Bennett proceeded to bomb Gaza on the night of June 15th to June 16th, and then again a second time during the same week on June 17th. In the Israeli and Western corporate media, the story was reported as the Israelis launching airstrikes in response to incendiary balloons launched by Hamas, which of course sounds very proportionate and civilized. Naturally, the media left out the part that this was a response to the flag march in Al-Quds, in the holy city of Jerusalem. One of the first actions taken by Bennett's administration was to approve a right-wing march through the streets of occupied Jerusalem. East Jerusalem was captured in the 1967 war and consequently annexed. It has been under illegal Israeli occupation ever since. These are the same mobs that have been carrying out pogroms for the last few months that just marched through Jerusalem, looting and damaging Palestinian-owned businesses. They have been filmed laughing and joking at the death of Palestinians, calling for a second Nakba and for the ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinian population. All of this, of course, with the protection of Israeli police who stand there and coddle them and do nothing. And not only that, but they participate with them in oppressing the Palestinians. One woman who held a Palestinian flag was filmed being beaten to the ground by Israeli police. Under Bennett, Palestinians were also offered 1 million vaccines by the Israelis, with one caveat: they're expired. And so not only does the medical apartheid continue, but all of the apartheid continues, all of the cruelty, the entire cruelty of the occupation in all its dimensions continues. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Dr. Bassem Naim. He is the former Palestinian health minister and now the head of the International Relations Office of Hamas in Gaza. Thank you for taking the time. It's a pleasure to have you on, Doctor.
Please, an honor to be with you today.
So, Doctor, I wanted to ask you, first of all, this new prime minister of the Israeli occupation, Naftali Bennett, he's made remarks in the past that he is proud to have killed Arabs. He is completely against any Palestinian state. I wanted to ask you, this change of leadership, does it mean anything for Palestinians? What does it actually represent on the ground in reality?
Look, for us Palestinians here, it doesn't make any difference between these different Israeli governments, right or left, and if it is a negative change. Look, when it comes to the Palestinian issue, we believe, and this is the practical thing we see on the ground, there is no differences between right and left. All what they are discussing is only internal issues, internal Israeli issues. But when it comes to the Palestinian conflict, when it comes to the borders, the settlements, to Jerusalem, to refugees, right to return, the right to attack Palestinians, to suffocate them, since 1948, we have a steady, constant policy from all governments. And if there is a change in, when it comes to this new government, maybe it is a negative one. I mean, more aggression, more violence against the Palestinian existence here on the land. But if there is a question, we have the right to raise it as Palestinians there today, that why the international community, in particular the West, Europe, and America, are usually exercising a lot of pressures on Palestinians to go on the path of what so-called peace and stability and prosperity, and they are asking us to review our curricula in the schools, they are asking us to review our media, and so on and so on. But when it comes to what so-called the prime minister, who is proud of killing Palestinians or Arabs in general, and he is ready to repeat it again and again, when we have a minister of interior, the so-called Ayelet Shaked, when she is publicly stated that she is calling for killing all Palestinian mothers because they are going to give birth for a new terrorist, I hope that the international community can leave the position of not only double standard, double or triple standards, and to hear clear, not only clear statements, but also actions towards the such terrorist government.
How does it make you feel to see Arabs, Palestinians in this coalition government? What kind of message does that send? How does that make you feel?
The Palestinians generally are divided here in two parties. One party see that this is their right to decide how to deal with the status quo without recognizing the occupation as a state. And the other part, which is forbidding totally any engagement, especially at the official level with the Israeli occupation. We here in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, I mean the occupied territories in 1967, we leave this for them to decide how to deal with this with their situation inside the occupied territories in 1948. But on the bottom line, the baseline is not to recognize this occupation or to legitimize it.
So, you know, Doctor, I wanted to ask you, we saw these Israeli marches through Al-Quds, through Jerusalem, where these mobs are chanting death to Arabs, you know, they're laughing and joking, they're calling for a second Nakba, for more ethnic cleansing. And at the same time, as you saw, unfortunately, they started bombing Gaza again. They broke the ceasefire on May 21st. You know, they attacked public health infrastructure. Many clinics and hospitals were damaged. At Shifa Hospital, which I'm sure you know very well, they bombed the road leading there. And I mean, it's not the first time, is it? But, you know, what do you have to say about this massacring of Palestinians that is still ongoing? the damage to infrastructure, the medical apartheid, in the broader context of the occupation of Palestine?
Look, when we hear this group of extremists chanting openly and publicly death to Arabs and death to Muslims, or calling for destroying Al-Aqsa Mosque, or on, it, and protected by the Israeli police and covered by all Israeli media, calling or considering them as heroes, this is reflecting that this is the official policy of the state of Israel. This is not a group of gangs at the periphery of the mainstream of the state. It is in the heart of this group of young people are representing Naftali Bennett and Ayla Shaqid and other official figures in the state of Israel. When it comes to the massacring of Palestinians, again, this is the adopted policy since 1948. Look, if you go through the diary, in each day you will find the memory or the anniversary, sorry, of one or two or three or sometimes in one day five or six massacres committed by the Israel, by the Zionist entity or their groups since 1948 until today. Either here in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, in Tunis, and everywhere. Therefore, again and again, this is the adopted official policy of this Zionist entity, how to eliminate the Palestinian existence on this land and around it. When it comes to attacking health facilities or killing children, usually they are using some allegations that they are targeting security offices or offices affiliated to the resistance. First of all, they were not able to show one proof of their allegations until today. Second, we know if they want to target someone specifically, they can do it. You know that they have the most sophisticated weapons, the most precise weapons supported by the Americans. Why to destroy a house or a building with 13 or 14 floor because of the allegations they have one or two offices in this high building working for the resistance.
And Doctor, just as a final question, you've been very gracious with your time. I just want to ask you, what can people who are listening, the viewers, what can they do to help the Palestinian cause? And you know, very often we never get to hear directly from Palestinians in the English-speaking world. Everything about Hamas is filtered through the Zionist narrative, through the Western narrative. So I want to give you the floor, and I want to ask you, what would you like to say directly to the viewers, to the audience?
Thank you very much. This is a very important question. And I will start from the point you have raised, because this is the most important point. The Israeli or the Zionist entity is depending on two pillars. The first one, their own capacity or capabilities here, security and air forces and army, and the other one, the international support, because they are presenting themselves as representative of the Western values, of the Western cultures, as a civilized state, as a state which is defending human rights and equity and so on. This image, I think anyone will be very helpful for the Palestinians if they convey the reality on the ground here, that this is a fascist colonial project violating all kinds of human rights, all kinds of good values, or the values of more or most civilized people, equity and justice and freedom of expression, freedom of journalism. We have seen it live in real time, how they are killing children, how they are attacking women, how they are squashing men and women on crossings in the West Bank or in Jerusalem. Therefore, to help Palestinians to convey their message or to convey the Palestinian narrative to pass through this filter is a very great help for us. The second thing is we Palestinians, we are not war, what we call it in English, we are not war makers or war lovers. We are really looking to live in peace. We are really looking to live that our children have the chance of a better life, a dignified life, to live like any children around the world. And we have given all the chances to the Zionist entity and to the international community to solve this political conflict in a peaceful way or a political way, avoiding further bloodshed and killing of people, of children, women. But they have always denied our basic rights of a statehood, of dignity, of freedom. Therefore, we have resorted to armed resistance, which is guaranteed right in the international law, by the way. It is our full right to resist the occupation. We are the oppressed people, and the Israelis are the oppressor, and we have the right to resist it. But we have resorted to this track or to this tool because we have seen after 7 decades that no one is really caring about our life, about our future.
Let us not forget that during his tenure, Netanyahu oversaw the assassinations of several Iranian nuclear scientists. He openly and vehemently rejected the Iran nuclear deal in any diplomatic endeavors. He approved several acts of sabotage and nuclear terrorism against Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities, and then had the nerve to go to the United Nations General Assembly and accuse Iran of developing a nuclear weapon, when Israel is the only party who has nuclear weapons. Netanyahu oversaw the brutal assaults on Gaza in 2014 and again in 2021, with thousands of Palestinians being ruthlessly murdered and wounded. In 2016, he secured the largest package of military aid from the United States in history, totaling $38 billion over a period of 10 years to subsidize these atrocities. He launched hundreds of airstrikes on Syria, if not thousands, taking advantage of the chaotic situation in Syria to attack her while she was weak. Under his rule, the Israelis openly worked to assist and give aid to Al-Qaeda fighters inside Syria just for the sake of helping to topple the Syrian government. Netanyahu tried to move forward with his annexation plan on July 1st, 2020, but ultimately didn't. His plans to annex a further 30% of the West Bank, they didn't come to fruition, but he still tried, and he still got something else in return: normalization of ties with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates in the form of the Abraham Accords, orchestrated by a grinning Trump, who also moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to occupy Jerusalem and recognized the illegally occupied Syrian Golan Heights as Israeli. So how different is Bennett if he supports all these and more? On the eve of Bennett taking power, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry issued a statement clearly saying that this is not real change, because there is no change in the attitude towards Palestinians. That, quote, "As for the new government's policies, we estimate we will see no difference or perhaps even worse ones." Similar statements were echoed by Hamas and Palestinians alike everywhere. And indeed, let us be under no illusions. Whether Netanyahu had stayed or is replaced by Bennett makes little difference. Perhaps Bennett is more direct in his approach and his rhetoric and speaks with more animosity, but his actions are just as bad as Netanyahu's, if not perhaps slightly worse. Just like his predecessor, he is in favor of annexation. He supports expanding the illegal settlements. He is in favor of brutal military assaults bombing Gaza, allowing Zionists to march through the streets of occupied Jerusalem, unchecked, chanting death to Arabs. Bennett is in favor of ethnic cleansing, of genocide, of oppressing Palestinians, and making sure they never attain statehood, nor be given their basic human rights. Bennett, just like Netanyahu, is the leader of an occupation. It's that simple. And unfortunately, this means that nothing changes on the ground. This means that Palestinians continue to live under a racist, apartheid entity, under colonialism that is supported and subsidized by the West. Indeed, nothing has changed, save for a few faces and a few names. The cruelty of oppression, of occupation, of colonialism and apartheid continues in all its dimensions. This has not changed and not stopped. And therefore, neither should the resistance to colonialism and imperialism. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the host of this program. This is Viewpoints. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, and we want to discuss another important topic regarding the speeches and the addresses of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Brother Ali Alevian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Brother Ali Alevian, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaykum assalam, thank you for having me here.
So today we want to talk about the important concept of adala, or justice, in the thoughts and the speeches of Ayatollah Khamenei. We get into different categorizations or typology that is given by Rahbar. He talks about adala in terms of religion, in terms of a person, society, politics, and also economics. And we want, inshallah, for today's discussion, discuss them one by one. Let's start with adalati dini, or the religious justice, Brother Ali Alevian. What does the Rahbar mean when he is talking about religious justice?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Yeah, that's it's the time to focus on the typology of justice, and as it is, it can be driven from the lectures and, let's say, speeches of the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Khamenei. The first one is religious justice. Look, we have said earlier in our previous session where we started this discussion on justice, we said that all the religions came to give us one common motto and one common slogan, which is justice. And they all look at justice as a compulsory and, let's say, mandatory introduction for the perfection of human being, Kamalul Insan, or Kamalul, or the genuine Kamal that we are all after.
That's right.
It has been already mentioned in Quran and in other divine books. We have seen that all of the prophets and all of the imams who were succeeding the prophets were focusing and emphasizing on the concept of adal. So there is no religion with this motto. So it, as I said, this is a common word between all religions. So this is what all religions actually come, and all the prophets were sent to spread justice on the scene of the earth. And in any time that there is a prophet, whether Ulul Azm or other prophets, or even imams at the absence of the prophets, so this concept needs to be spread and actually explained to the people. So it has also different forms of adala itself that Islam wants us to know about. One is individual, and second is social adala, social justice. Economic justice and political justice, these are the different formats of it that we need to focus and think about. And it is explicitly mentioned in the chapter of Al-Hadid, that لِيَقُمُ النَّاسَ بِالْقِسْطِ, that the Prophet came to invite people towards justice. And also we have in a hadith the hadith that actually refer to the concept of intibar, or expectation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, or the advent of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the last savior. He is going to come to spread justice among people. So we see this is a common goal among the religions, the divine books, and also those who are interpreters of these religions and divine books, that is prophets and imams, to emphasize on the concept of justice. And there is no religion without justice.
Okay. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, it seems that the religious justice is not only limited to the religion of Islam, and the other religions, Abrahamic religions, are talking about the concept of adala too. It seems that it is a universal concept existing in all religions. What is the exact difference between religious justice in terms of Islam and the other Abrahamic religions, I mean Christianity and Judaism?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we look at the other Abrahamic religions, the actual religion itself, when the prophets were there, for example, Prophet Musa and Prophet Jesus alayhi salam or alayhi salam, in their time, when they were among their people, it was the same concept as we have now. Because obviously they were the prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is also a prophet. So, but after them, obviously, the meaning was changed by the followers of those religions. And today, the most common, we can say, definition which they bring is that is equality, basically.
That's right.
They take the name of justice, but they talk about equality.
That's right.
The equal rights of the people, not the just rights of the people.
Yeah, equal payments, equal payments, gender rights.
Equal gender rights. Yeah. So basically, because the definition was changed, that's why we can say, like, in Renaissance, after Renaissance and all those, the religion couldn't answer the questions of the people. It wasn't, it couldn't answer in the matter of justice. It couldn't answer in the matter of economics and other things that we have, obviously, they had in their religion. So because they couldn't answer the religions, that's why the new social, we can say, like, system or modernism was started later.
Right.
So the main difference, if I just can just talk about the main difference, is that Islam is paying attention towards the actual definition of justice, and it seems justice other than the musawat or the equality.
That's all right. But when you're talking about adala inside a religious atmosphere and context, the people's expectations are higher now, because it seems that when the religion's motto and slogan is justice, when the people are living, for example, in a Muslim land, an Islamic land, they expect their rulers to observe justice more than the other secular part of the world. But at the same time, we could see that these justice movements, Brother Alevian, in the West,
mm-hmm.
are more active. And this is what attracted some of the Muslims from the Muslim lands mm-hmm. in order to migrate to the Western countries
mm-hmm.
for the justice that is observed over there. Is this a true picture that the Muslims have, or no, this is a shortcoming of the Muslim rulers in their own land?
Your explanation and your question actually reminds me of what the famous sentence by Sayyid Jamaluddin Asadabadi, when
okay.
he said that, "I have seen Islam in the West and I have seen Muslim in the East."
Okay.
Yes, unfortunately, as we shall, inshallah, reach to that point to talk about the principles of implementation of adal or justice, the leaders, those who are going to establish adal and justice, they need to be just first. So there are some issues with the people themselves, those who are in charge, actually, I'm talking about. So first, they need to work on their own selves, to purify their own selves, to do self-building by themselves first, then prepare the society. And when I am doing good, then I can actually ask others to do good as well. So when I am still with problems and I've not yet worked on myself, it's quite famous among akhlaq teachers that they never say something that they are not actually doing themselves. They are not amil by themselves.
Practicers.
And they are themselves first practicers of
That's
what
right.
they are actually prescribing for others.
Okay.
So this is one of the problems that we are facing in the in our country, in our societies. But let's say very clearly that whatever we see, and this picture that we are seeing from the West, is not what reality is. What
mm-hmm.
is not what it is in reality. It is famous that the grass is greener in the other side. But when we go and check, we see that there are some, let's say, mechanic or digital criteria that keeps them to stay in that status. So it's not something internal that makes them to be just. And so I don't want to condemn and say that whatever they are doing is not good. So at least we need to be like them in that area.
Okay.
But I want to say what I want to say and transfer is that it is not something internal as Islam or if any other religion is asking us to be. So a person who is at the top, he himself should be just in order to implement justice. Are they really just whatever we see in the West, the picture from the leaders of the
okay.
West? Are they really just? This is something that is under question
right.
and needs to be discussed, I think.
Okay.